Well, good evening. It is Tuesday, November 25th, 2014, and this is The Refinery, the place where grassroots organizations come together to explore the best ways to make conservative messaging work, to reach and influence even more people. You can watch us live every Tuesday night at 8:30 Central on therefineryshow.com. That page also has some links for you to listen or download the podcast at Vigilant Liberty Radio, or you can see the wonderful YouTube clips that JD and Felicia make for the show every week. There's like six every week of good 5-minute bites of the show that can give you a good introduction into what we are. Our conservative grassroots organizations are the Conservative Union from Google Plus. I am Leslie P. from there, and we have Ryan Bickmore, also from Conservative Union. Then we have Free Radical Network, represented by Felicia Cravens and J.D. Bryden. And then we have the Party of Choice with Corey and Andy Paith. Paith, right? Not Paith. It's spelled Paith. It looks like Paith, but it's not Paith. So, guys, it's been a really big week. We had just a plethora of topics to discuss. Oh my gosh. And I guess it makes sense for us to start with news of the day, although that's not really our main focus here in this show, but it would be wrong to not discuss Ferguson, because it's, I don't know what to say about Ferguson anymore. I just don't. Anybody have any wise insight into, I'm just going to go with the assumption that our listeners understand when I just say Ferguson, because the decision came out last night. There's not going to be an indictment for Darren Wilson, and rioting happened. 40 businesses were torched. Sharpton and Jackson, of course, had something to say, and Obama had something to say, and it interrupted my TV watching. that was the only funny part of it. I mean, because the whole thing isn't funny at all. Who has anything important, not important, but interesting, good, and insightful to say? Corey and Andy?
Oh, nothing interesting and insightful, but I will say that I haven't said anything interesting and insightful since I left the womb.
You lie.
It's just not my way. Look, I will say this. I think this has nothing to do with race. And here's what I mean. It has everything to do with liberalism versus conservatism. How many of these people rampaging in the streets there are black conservatives? Zero. Okay? And as I've said many times, it's about time we start facing the facts that virtually, not all, but virtually all crime is committed by the left. You know, I grew up with the left. I saw it. I was always embarrassed that I and my family were like these intellectual defense attorneys for an entire movement. You know, be it militant jihad or gang wars or radical abortionists like Gosnell or rioting or, or drug dealing and all this kind of stuff. Virtually all of it's done by the left. And here's what really amazes me, folks. The most well-armed group, you know, people say if you are well-armed, you're going to commit crimes and commit violent crimes and kill people. The most well-armed group in America is the NRA, and they do virtually nothing wrong. I think that what's happening in Ferguson, which is, let's face it, it's a tragedy what happened to the young man. He brought it on himself, but that doesn't mean I want him dead. It's a tragedy what happened. That's terrible. You never want to see that. But the evidence seemed pretty clear. Apparently, it was so overwhelmingly clear, they could not even send it to trial for the lightest of charges. And yet, all of this happened. This isn't, you know, I get worried that we charge in, and by we, I don't mean us here, I mean a lot of maybe even white America, we charge in and say, this is black America run amok. No, it isn't. Liberalism run amok. It's liberalism. Because let me tell you something, there's no Alan West out there. There's no Herman Cain out there. There's no Condi Rice out there. And there's none of that out there. This is liberalism.
I kind of wish there was a Mia Love out there. I kind of wish there was an Alan West out there. I kind of wish there was a Herman Cain out there to talk about this and to try and you know, That's another thing, is that these communities are being devastated right now by this looting, and it just seems like there's a vacuum of leadership. And, you know, I don't know exactly what to do about that. I don't know if there's anything that I can do. I don't know if there's anybody who should be going in there and talking about it. I mean, the only person that I can think of that actually has been to Ferguson, you know, high-profile figure that's actually been to Ferguson and talked about it, is Rand Paul. Where is the rest of our team going into Ferguson to talk about these issues and to try and, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's a real vacuum of power, of leadership, and it's devolving into riots in the streets.
Well, in the way that I think one would want someone from our side to go in is, you know, bringing assistance, bringing people to help, you know, rebuild certain places without any sort of political agenda, you know, no speeches, no talking in front of people, listening in front of people, and be seen to be doing that. That's a more productive use of time for anyone on the conservative side, I think, than showing up and attempting to talk at people about, you know, racial issues, especially, you know, if we're talking white, older male people that are going in there. Just, I think it comes better from the perspective of, I'm here, I'm ready to help. I wanted to spend the day doing something to help the people of Ferguson and to listen to them, period.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't see anyone doing that from any of the political parties. I mean, the president didn't go there. The president decided to... Sorry, go ahead.
When they had the protests in the first place, way back, there were Tea Party groups from St. Louis that got together and went to Ferguson and helped clean up some of the stores and helped some of the shop owners. And, you know, that would be, a welcome thing to happen again, to go help sweep up the broken glass. And, I mean, there was a picture on the Blaze of the guy who runs the Ferguson Liquor and Meat Market. That was the place that Michael Brown stole the cigarillos from that night. So it was he was burglarized that night, and we saw the video, and that guy was shoved around by Michael Brown. But apparently last night, that market was broken into. It was looted pretty badly yesterday, and there's a picture, it's a little Vine clip of a guy asked him, "Are you okay?" And you just see the man, and he's a small Indian man, Indian or Pakistani. I mean, he's a Middle Eastern looking guy, owner of the store, and he just has this, you know, kind of the humble appearance that most of them tend to have when they're shop owners. And he just said, you know, "Yes, sir, I'm okay." Just very quiet, looking through his messed up store. And, you know, it just breaks my heart. It makes me like, I want to get in my car, drive there and grab a broom and help him.
You know, and a lot of conservatives will, and I know that's going to happen. As always, we ride in as the good guys. And there will be liberals who ride in as the good guys also and help rebuild some of these things. And Leslie, all I can do is echo what you're saying. That's the best way to send a message. Get your hands dirty. Roll up your sleeves. Help.
And you don't have to be there. I remember during August when the original event happened, one of the things Tony Katz did was pledge to have a large order from the meat market. Anybody that has a store there that has the ability to ship things, you can shop from wherever. Maybe what we got to do, and I'll think about if somebody hasn't got one of these already, is compiling a list of some businesses there that we can help from afar.
That's a really good idea. That's a really good idea. I like that.
We don't have to even necessarily have somewhere that ships far. We can just say, here's $100, take it to someone in your neighborhood that needs help. I mean, I'm sure a lot of them would have a good idea of who needs help in their neighborhood, or a poor neighborhood in town or something like that.
Yeah, it's important to have somebody on the ground to coordinate that sort of thing. I don't know who has contacts, but I'm sure that we have contacts who have contacts on the ground. I can think of two or three right off the top of my head. So I'll look into that. If we end up finding a way to do that, We'll put it in the show notes, the description of the video, and people can find out there more.
Yeah. Getting out there and helping these businesses is a huge thing to do, and something that everybody can do at least a little bit. Fishy, I know that you wanted me to get these pictures from the Kickstarter for Natalie's Cakes.
Right. Natalie's Cakes. This picture showed up last night, I think, in the middle of all of the problems with the riots and everything. And Natalie's Cakes had her windows busted out in the middle of all this. And I think here's a picture of her reaction to seeing that. And then Chad Kent, who's Chad Kent Speaks on Twitter and good friend of ours, Chad Kent posted the picture and said, you know, I think it's good to have the picture going around and people to know sort of the stories of what's happening on the ground. But he said, it's more important for us to also think about how to help. And he said, is there any way, he just threw the question out there, is there any way to help this woman, Natalie, specifically, you know, and other people like her, in order to, you know, I guess express solidarity, support the small businesses, the people that are struggling because of all the events that are happening there. And within maybe 30 minutes of me asking on Twitter if anybody had set something up, a person I don't even know tweeted me the information and told me where to find Natalie's Facebook page, which we're going to put the link in the chat for people. Natalie's Cakes and More has their own Facebook page. They have been two separate people have set up a GoFundMe for Natalie and her business so that she's not financially harmed with this. And we'll have the link for that as well. And it was a great illustration of how quickly people, and I'm not going to say conservatives or liberals or anything, but just people, just humans who feel for someone else who's having a really difficult situation happen, how quickly they can respond and how quickly they have responded. Not just one person, but two people took it upon themselves to help raise money for her. And she's feeling the effects of that immediately. And it sort of gave her a different look. I know JD has another picture that he can show that they posted after the news of all that came out. And there's Natalie and, ready to keep the business going, ready to attempt to make sure that she can go forward and still have her business. I just thought it was a beautiful thing. Within 30 minutes, strangers, people that we didn't know, had, upon inquiry, had directed me and thus Chad and thus all the people Chad talks to a place to help someone. And that is the beauty of social media at times like this, too. Yeah, you hear a lot of things that are going on. I saw some really wretched tweets last night in the middle of all the burning and the rioting and the looting. And my heart was really hurt over that. It was really painful to read a lot of the things that I read through my stream from all ends of the spectrum. And then to have this news this morning, today, it was such a breath of fresh air. I was so glad to see that this sort of thing happens, and happens lightning fast.
Because if you give us time, you know, our first reaction is going to be nasty and angry, and unfortunately we have social media to allow us to be public in our nasty, angry, emotional first reactions. But if you give most people a minute and a half to calm down, to think about it, to converse with other human beings, and to see the human faces behind things, and to really get to the humanity behind these big issues, they will stop and say, oh my gosh, that really is true. There are car dealerships that have been torched, and their insurance policy is not going to cover a riot. This woman who runs a cake shop, the guy who runs the liquor store, the dry cleaner, the franchisee who has the auto parts store, these guys are really in trouble, and they're going to need some help, and we want that help to come from people, not from a big federal government.
Yeah, there's one thing I want to briefly touch on, something that I heard on one of the live streams last night. And it goes back to what Andy was saying about this is not a racial thing. This is a liberal thing. As the people were looting last night, I heard several times, no, not that business. That's a local business. Get the corporate ones. You know, attacking corporations and stuff like that. It was very interesting to see that. You know, we've heard a lot about it not being locals that are causing all of this destruction, but there's definitely
anarchists were there.
There was a real anarchist presence in Ferguson.
I got to say, too, that one of the streams that I was listening to, they kept reiterating how many Illinois license plates they saw. Take make of that what you will. They were counting and writing down Illinois license plates.
As well they should. I think we want to move on now since it is Thanksgiving week. We want to move on and hit some. Sure.
One last thing, I just want to reiterate something JD has brought up in the past. Rand Paul's talk about, you know, one thing we can do beyond, you know, helping the individual businesses and stuff is continue pushing for legislation to move, bring the free market back into these inner city zones, you know, tax-free, you know, low-tax zones and stuff like that, enterprise zones and things. Let's bring America back into the inner city because it's being run by people who hate America. And let's show them the beauty of a country that they think has left them. I just thought I'd throw that out.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe we want to move on to groupering next, which is it's a fascinating bit of stuff that obviously we talked about groupering last week, and the huge explosion of you know, conservative messaging that's developed around it. It's been a real amazing sort of whirlwind around that, and the sort of distrust that it's caused. I think it's really poisoned the well.
The news on Gruber this week was that a couple of states canceled their contracts with him, so he has been personally financially injured by the revelations of who and what he is truly. That's what's astounding. It's not that secrets were revealed about him. It's that the public learned who he has publicly been all along.
Right, and sadly, he's only losing his $500,000 contracts, not his
right.
$5 million contracts that he had
right.
With the federal government.
But you know, it's a twist when, you know, the people who hired him can't say, oh my gosh, we never knew this about him. They're firing him because the public found out who this guy they hired was, and the public is not okay with. I mean, that's just kind of an interesting twist. It's not that your boss found out who you really are. It's that your customers found out who your boss hired. And the boss says, oh, you know what? My customers don't want this scumbag that I hired, so I'm going to have to throw the scumbag under the bus. Even though he's doing exactly what I wanted him to do, I'm going to have to pretend like I didn't want him to be this way, because what he is actually something that my customers find to be heinous.
Does anything that Gruber said they did, I mean, does any, Gruber laid out all the dishonest strategizing that he said was going on behind the scenes. He laid all that out. Here's the question. Well, I have two questions. First one is, did any of that not happen?
All of it happened. He was absolutely right about all of it.
Yes. They implemented the lie, every strategy, every kooky, evil, twisted, wicked thing that he said that they should do. They implemented all that. So how can they come out and say you know, we what he said was detestable. What? You implemented every last word of what he said. My goodness. You know, it's just like with the blueprint in Colorado and so forth. You know, at one point, you know, they're talking here, you know, that they wanted to target, what was it, the stupid people? Or educate the stupid people. And one of the groups that they were targeting were black people. Okay? This is, look, this is just where they are. I do have one other question, though. Because while what Gruber said was far more egregious than what Todd Akin said on our side, because Akin made one comment, Gruber made several long streaming, you know, terrible comments. And yet Akin was calamitous. Give me a scorecard. Which one of them is going to do more to bring down his party? Akin at that time or Gruber now?
Akin at that time. Akin actually separated his party because we had, you know, he got yelled at by members of his own party. He got ostracized by his own party. And the Akin effect hurt other people in his own party. Gruber is, is Gruber being big time denounced the way our side denounced Akin?
Yes.
They're disagreeing with his comments more than they're disagreeing with anything else. Plus, he's not a politician. He's a scholar. He's not a politician, so he gets a special exemption.
He's underbussable, definitely. But he's not got a brand on him. He's very progressive, but he doesn't carry it, you know, he's not responsible for carrying a Democrat brand. Now, we can utilize that, and I think we should, but as far as damage to the party in general, I don't think people are wandering around yet saying, Democrats lie to us. Democrats lie to us.
Everything they say is a lie.
Well, obviously. would you guys say that is because of the media dominance of the left, that they obviously heard Akin everywhere and hear Gruber only in, you know, in grudging minute detail because it becomes embarrassing to them that it's everywhere on Fox and the internet.
Yes.
Do you think that's the reason, or do you think it's because Akin committed the really high crime of not dropping out?
I think it's because the issues are also inherently different. The way that abortion is polarizing is far different from the way that Obamacare is polarizing. So again, since Gruber is not an elected official, since he's not a Democrat with a, you know, he doesn't have a D next to his name, it's really hard to really use that to smudge the... Sorry, go ahead, Fishy.
No, look at what you're actually having the people have to do, though. Do we understand how the CBO scores anything? That's what he's talking about. He was talking to a room of people who were in the field of government and bill writing and or progressive politics in general. Explaining that to people, what they've actually done, is different from having the words come out of his mouth, you know, that taking advantage of the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. Those are two separate things. Akin, there was no divide about what Akin was saying. There was no, you know, low-level messaging and then higher-level, here's what he really said, but people are misunderstanding it. There was nothing like that. It was plain and clear and understandable to everybody. Part of the problem with Gruber is, unless you are going to stop at, they lied, it's going to take too long to explain.
Yep, and that is the key problem. One of the ways to get around that problem, I think Kurt Schlichter has a pretty good way to get around that, and it's just by keep on constantly using the Grubering meme.
Turn it into the verb that everybody just knows what Grubering means.
Yeah, and that's
conventional wisdom.
It worked for Santorum. Doing that, and this is actually a case where we legitimately have a cause to this. It's not something that some jerk came up with on the internet. That's something completely different. Fishy just put one of the best quotes from Kurt Schlichter's recent article, America, You've Been Groovered, which is absolutely excellent, and we'll put it in the links and put it in the chat right now. But one of the best quotes: the most important effect of the revelations of the administration's flunkies' history of cheesy lies about Obamacare is that liberals must now answer one threshold question before discussing the substance of any new socialist scheme. Why should we trust anything liberals say about anything? I mean, that in and of itself is a pretty huge point. If we already have them on tape saying they're stupid, they won't catch the lie because they're too stupid. Second, you know, we don't mind lying, so let's be opaque. Let's not be transparent. Let's cover things up.
I think that needs to be a part of every political discussion we're in. Anytime we're talking to a liberal, okay, fine, they said that this will happen. Why should we believe anything they say? They lied to us about, and then list off three or four quick things, huge things like Obamacare. You know, use the Gruber verb like Schlichter suggests. You know, they Grubered us on this and this and this and this. So why should we believe anything they say? And that should shut the discussion down right there if they're intellectually honest.
One thing that I heard, and it struck me that I've heard this repeatedly when we discussed the issue of why is the Gruber thing so non-damaging, whereas the Aiken thing was. It's because the Aiken thing was simple and the Gruber thing is not. Doesn't it seem that almost every conservative problem is simple for them to message around and every liberal problem is difficult for us to message around? Is that the case? Or are we just not good at figuring out the simple way to message it? Because the simple way to message Gruber is liberals lie about everything. That's easy. I think we've accepted the premise that, well, what Gruber said, it was so complicated. He was talking CBO, and it was very complex, and you have to listen, and he's just a propeller head guy, and he's just an advisor, and it's really no big deal. Whereas insignificant Todd Aiken was able to kind of take down the Republican Party because we allowed them to successfully simplify and globalize everything, and we don't use a counter strategy on stuff that should be even far more damaging and far more damning.
Well, I think part of it too is the message transmission media that we don't have as well.
Right.
It's very easy for the left to simplify big issues. And
because they've got thousands of people thinking on it and figuring out how.
Indeed, and they're all coordinating to find the best message. You don't see that on the right. Yes, exactly. You do not see that sort of coordination on the right. And Aiken, honestly, from what I gathered about the whole thing, was sort of not helped, not made, nobody made any attempt to rehabilitate him. And I get that. I get that. I understand that decision. But it is a habit on the right that we do throw out, you know, people who get, I've done it myself, you know, people get toxic in an area and don't, you know, you don't want to have anything to do with them anymore because they've got the taint on them. So we don't try to rehabilitate our guys. I mean, think of all the rehabilitation that's gone into several left senators or politicians or, you know,
Marion Barry, Anthony Weiner, yes.
Ted Kennedy.
They stand behind their guys and they rehabilitate them.
They do.
Yeah, but keep in mind, a lot of those you mentioned were in hard left districts and states to where you could rehab them through the system. I mean, you could rehab them in the public eye and they could survive it. Todd Aiken did an incredible disservice by not stepping down immediately out of that election. And he did it because, look, I don't know anything about that. All I know is he said one bad thing. For all I know, everything else he's ever said is terrific. Okay, he's not like Anthony Weiner. He's not a repeat offender on this kind of thing. But what he did was incredibly selfish and sent a message to conservatism, the GOP, the Tea Party, and everybody on our side, I only care about me, and I don't care what this does to you. that was the problem, and that is the thing that rehabbing that has to be done behind the scenes after an election.
And you know what? I know this is going to be this might sound a little weird and counterintuitive, but in a way, maybe we learned from the Aiken incident because we didn't have that this year. I mean, that's right. Not something that we had. So maybe it was important to have our Aiken and Murdoch moments and then learn from it, because we did have interventions, campaign mm-hmm. interventions. There was no Robert Irvine showing up to do a restaurant rebuild, but it was, they definitely happened. People were sent in to revitalize and fix campaigns. So,
well, there's no question. I mean, there's no question we learned from it, and in that way, he did a phenomenal service for us. But
and we're here coordinating messaging, so we're learning that too.
Yeah, but that's no thanks to him.
Well, no, but we're getting better. I don't care about Todd Aiken. I'm tired of talking about him. I want him to just disappear. But we're learning and getting better about coordinating our messaging, and the idea of spreading Kurt Schlichter with the Grubering idea, spreading that idea far and wide, is kind of a cool one, and is us moving forward and learning from Aiken and Murdoch and all of the little name. Who was the toe tapping guy?
Oh, I totally blocked that out.
Yeah, that guy. Remember, there have been politicians of ours, low-level politicians, that we've allowed to become the story for too long, and we haven't seized the initiative when the story was ours. I mean, this Gruber thing is light years beyond anything that a weird congressperson, the witch girl, any light years beyond any damage that some weird congressperson saying some weird thing is. And I think we're learning how, and we have to capitalize on this Gruber thing, both to kill Obamacare, and we can use Grubering to kill some of the immigration stuff too, can't we? That concept?
Right. I wanted Ryan to talk about his Obamacare experience here. He was going to bring that up too, and talking
about he got Grubered?
A real person who really was harmed and has just this horrible wrench in his plans here.
Okay, so about a month ago, I think I mentioned on the refinery that I got my own notice in the mail that even though we liked our plan, we couldn't keep it. If we kept paying, we'd automatically be enrolled in a different, more expensive plan. If not, we can try to go on the exchanges and find. Today, I talked to my insurance agent who's helped me get insurance in the past, and she sent me a quote with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, looks like 15 different plans that we can choose from. Every one of them is more expensive than the plan we currently have. The cheapest one is $519 a month for our family of four. The deductible is $11,000, which there's no way we can afford. The out-of-pocket maximum is $12,800. Coinsurance is 30%. Like, there's no way we can afford to pay $500 in medical bills per month and then also another $11,000 for the deductible. Plans go from there up to $900 a month. So we liked our plan. It had worked for us. My son has needed it quite a bit. We like our doctors, we like our hospitals, and now we can't keep it. So we got Grubered, and that sucks. And I talked to my insurance agent. I said, this is too expensive. We can't afford this. My work has to provide a plan because we have over 50 or 100 employees. That's going to cost the work a ton of money that we don't have right now to spend, which is a totally different thing. I mean, we'll figure out what to do, but that's going to hurt us a lot. And since what they offer for just me is less than 9% of my annual income, I think I don't qualify for any subsidies, is what they said. So I don't qualify for any subsidies, and I can't afford it, and we need it for my son's surgeries going forward, so I have no idea what we are going to do. I think the only option I'm really left with is what Alan Grayson claimed that the Republicans wanted to do. Just don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly, because I can't afford to pay for the insurance anymore.
What you said about the lowest cost plan is something that I think people are beginning to understand. There are a lot of people, you know, Obama will toss out the numbers of how many millions of people have gotten insurance that didn't have insurance before, and those numbers are all grossly inflated, but he tosses out those numbers anyway. But for a large number of those people, they got the bronze plan. They got the lowest cost plan that they were required by law to pay for, and the coverage that they're getting has such a high deductible, like a $12,000 a year deductible, and they have $200-$300 a month or whatever just for them. They are effectively still uninsured because their deductible is so high. Their premium is, to get a reasonable premium, they have such a high deductible that for medical care, they're going to go to the Walmart medical clinics and they're going to pay cash. So we are effectively raising taxes on people. They're paying their monthly health care premium is just a tax, even though it's going to an insurance company. It all rolls up to the government because that pays for free medical care for the really indigent, and they end up, and these people who have the low insurance, they are effectively uninsured. They're in the cash medical care market, so we're going to see an explosion of more and more of the neighborhood quick clinics and the emergency centers, and this is where you go when you have a cold, because people are just going to become cash medical customers. Long term, I think that's why and how we're going to end up with free market health care, even in spite of Obama, because a single-payer system was never, ever going to work in this nation. It was always going to end up defaulting to a free market health care system, and we're going to get there, I think, fairly quickly because Obamacare is so very, very bad. But in the meantime, we'll have people like Ryan's family who end up, you're going to pay monthly for health insurance that you actually never use. So you're paying for health insurance and paying cash for all your medical bills and praying, dear sweet Jesus, don't let me get sick.
And essentially all that you're doing is paying to get into a doctor or a hospital that, you know, will ask you for an insurance card before they'll treat you.
Right. Well,
that's the purchase of what you're purchasing is a card that a doctor will look at and say, okay, well, I can treat you.
So here's my question then. If you have people who are having to pay for insurance plans that they can't afford, and then they do incur medical bills that they can't pay, then what? Especially if they are in Obamacare. Because if they're enrolled in Obamacare, then you've given the government all of your banking information. So if you've given them their banking information, it's just like the IRS garnishing your wages. How long before people's whole entire livelihoods are frozen?
I would imagine not too long. I mean, first they'll start withholding any of your refunds at the end of the year, and then they'll start garnishing your wages. So people will figure out ways around that. They will work in the tipped economy. They will work in the cash economy so that they don't have wages that can be garnished. You can see not too far ahead,
right,
that this falls apart very fast.
And another thing to think about, too, with all of that in terms of people getting their wages garnished, if they don't participate in Obamacare, they can't be fined as long as they're not getting, they can't get the fines collected as long as they're not getting tax returns, tax refunds. So right. If you structure your taxes so that you don't pay or you pay just a little, or you don't get back very much, or you just pay a little bit, then they can't come after you and fine you because there's no way for them to achieve it because of the way they wrote the law. And then on top of that, you're pushing yourself into a cash-only sort of medical treatment arrangement anyway. I think you're right. I hadn't thought of that, Leslie, but I think you're right. That is a faster way to market a free market healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Because the free market is always going to win, because Walmart is going to figure out a way to have a health clinic in the front of every facility, because Walmart will figure out a cheaper way to provide high-quality healthcare, and they're already doing it. We see it here in Houston, because we have the massive number of illegal immigrants who are outside of the system, and they're not paying for insurance from their employers because they choose not to, or because their employer doesn't provide it, or they own their own company and don't provide insurance for themselves and their workers. So they're going to all of these cash clinics. The number of clinics that have cropped up in Houston for cash customers, and you go into the clinic, they don't even ask if you have insurance. You just pay cash. And they have, guess what? They have fewer administrators. They can function a lot more efficiently because you have a doctor and a nurse and maybe one administrator, rather than a traditional or a new style health clinic that'll have one doctor, five insurance administrators, and a bookkeeper, three accountants, one person collecting debts, and so their overhead is a lot higher. They have to charge more to the insurance companies when they get reimbursed. These cash clinics can be much cheaper. We're going to have a return to lodge medicine like we had 100 years ago. It will ultimately be good, because I have faith in the American people and our ingenuity. We will figure out ways around this crap hole of a government program. But for the next 3 or 4 years, I think for a lot of people like Ryan and like many of us here, it's going to suck, and it's going to suck bad.
Well, Ryan, my heart just breaks for you. I mean, I do not have words to say how much my heart breaks for you. Politically, I can just say it is so sad. It is so sad that not just Ryan, but so many families like his cannot benefit from all the great ideas that conservatives have put forward that would have dropped costs immeasurably, from loser pays legislation, which by far and away would be the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing would lower costs more than loser pays legislation, getting rid of the frivolous lawsuits. That drives up costs at every single level of production in medicine more than anything, and that kills families, financially. Buying across state lines, medical savings accounts and so forth. All these great ideas, it's our president dishonestly grubbered America, and especially families like Ryan, but it's also all the things they denied us that would have completely changed the scenario. Instead, Ryan's paying taxes to pay for the health care of people who don't want to work, honestly.
I think Ryan has a message to close out this segment. We want to move on to immigration, but Ryan's got a closing message.
Yeah, I just, thanks for that, Andy. That was nice. But I want to say also thank you to all the voters out there who thought that they knew what was good for me and my family better than I did. They thought that they could make a plan that would work, or they could lower costs or something like that. So to all of you who now I can't afford my insurance or will have to take lesser coverage or try to find help by paying cash or whatever we have to do to take care of my son, thanks a lot for that. Thanks for not giving me the choice to do what I wanted to do and what was best for my family.
I think that's the saddest segment we've ever had.
Do we talk immigration
now?
I think so. I think so, because we went from Greenbring.
Now I'm gonna. And when's the part on Sprockets when I slash my wrist?
That's terrible. That's terrible. And don't make me laugh. I've got a cold. It hurts me when I laugh. I think that we should move from Grubering on Obamacare to Grubering on amnesty. And that's a huge thing. Like, we talk a lot about John Boehner. and Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, who we've been a little bit nicer to than John Boehner, because Boehner has done some stuff that's legitimately... but he did write an article recently. 22 times President Obama said he couldn't ignore or create his own immigration law.
And he did it anyway. You've been America. Anyway. You've been Grubered.
You've absolutely been Grubered again by the president saying, hey, you know what? We're not going to do this. I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. It's not within my powers. Oh, wait, I did it. And there you go. Last Saturday, I need to touch on this. You know, aside from the craziness of the actual executive amnesty that he signed that he put into place, and the left trying to say, oh well, Reagan did it and George W. Bush George H. W. Bush did it. Those were in reference to bills that were actually in Congress that were done to help, that actually reflected bills that were being passed by, being passed by the legislation, legislators. Obama doesn't have that. That's not what he's doing. It's completely different. And Saturday Night Live, I mean, it blew me away. But Saturday Night Live, their cold open on Saturday night was I'm Just a Bill. They did a parody of the Schoolhouse Rock, I'm Just a Bill, where they had President Obama kick the bill down the steps repeatedly in front of Congress, repeatedly kicked down the steps three times it happened. And the bill said that it was a possible Republican immigration bill, kicked down the stairs three times by executive order that pretty much just happens. It's just it was an amazing skit.
That was the funniest SNL skit I've seen in a while, and it was absolutely the way SNL should always be. It was done well technically. I mean, it was a blend of animation and music and acting and costumes. The script, the writing was good. There was some good ad-libbing as the guy pretended to be falling down the stairs. I mean, the comic timing was really good. The fact that the executive order wanders on and he's smoking a cigarette, that was like an extra layer of mockery that they had in there of the president. It was political humor done really well, that SNL hasn't done that in a long time, because they've been afraid to mock this president or anything he did, and they absolutely did a great job with it, and they got fact-checked by the media.
That was the funniest part. I mean, why on earth would the Washington Post be fact-checking a skit unless they were actually afraid of the message?
Because they have to defend Obama at any cost.
I know, it's amazing. And, you know, my favorite part of that skit was when the executive order read himself, and he was just appalled. He couldn't believe what he was about to be doing.
was awesome, because he said, yeah, I'm executive order, and I do things like I name parks and declare holidays, and what?
Go big or go home, huh?
That was funny. That was funny.
Absolutely, and you know the fact that it happened is a huge thing. I know Fishy talked about it last week, the left has some important decisions to make about throwing people under the bus, and that seemed like a pretty good indicator of their willingness to start throwing people under the bus. And it was huge. And, you know, as funny as the skit was, and as important as the skit was, all of that was great. My favorite part of the skit was when Ted Cruz went on whatever Fox's Sunday news show and basically referenced the skit, told people to go and check out the skit, saying that he couldn't do a better job than the skit in illustrating exactly what lawlessness is going on through this executive order, that he couldn't do a better job of showing exactly how bad this is. And he went through the skit and used it as a tool. He took a cultural event and he used it to promote conservatism. And that was something that we rarely see done, and something that I was so happy to see.
Right. And Twitchy did a great job of sort of collating all the tweets about the hashtag WAPO fact checks. And what they did is they went back, and this is, again, the kind of mockery of the left that's really productive. We talked about that last week in terms of the Like a Boss meme, but what the conservatives are very good at doing, and this was beautiful that they did that, they went back and said, you know, the Coneheads were not actually from, what is it, Remulac, but they were from Canada. You know, and that it wasn't actually Joe Cocker doing the Help for My Friends version when John Belushi, you know, did that imitation. They went through all of these things that, you know, Bag of Glass from the 70s SNL was not actually a toy. And things like this. It was great poking fun at WAPO for thinking that they had to fact check this when I can see Russia from my house. And they were silent in 2008.
Right.
It was ridiculous, the concept that they would have to fact check an SNL skit. And the right on Twitter took them to task for it. And that was super productive because it got that into the general broader culture much more.
Well, and that's a good thing. I think there was a time in somewhere in the last 6 years that they've fact checked SNL before when there was something that SNL did that was just very much a little bit critical of Obama or one of his policies. But you know, Washington Post, they fact check what they do 5 or 6 a week, and of the 5 or 6 things that happened in all of media, one of the things that they decided needed to be fact-checked in order to provide ombudsman expertise to the world and to make sure that lies are not propagated across the sphere of American political understanding, they chose an SNL skit.
And it's beautiful because, too, when you're looking at SNL and the tone that they took with this, they had public support, you know, already. They gauged the nation's sentiment. You had the election results, and then you had, you know, specific election results that we've talked about in certain communities about certain policies. They made a very, very fleeting reference to immigration, but pretty much people who were watching it caught those references and knew what they were talking about. They were talking about an executive amnesty. It was very clear what the issue was. And they called BS on it. And they called BS on it in the most imaginative and creative way possible, with a cultural reference that everybody who's over a certain age, or you know, even younger since they've released them out on YouTube and DVD, they resonate with that. How many of us went to college and learned that song so that we could remember how to answer that question in our civics, civics courses? I sure did.
Oh, yeah. We all know Schoolhouse Rock. The classic Schoolhouse Rock. That's how we know, and Conjunction Junction. I mean, we all know this stuff, and we know that 1920 was the year that they struck down that restrictive law and gave women the vote. I mean, that's how I know history. Because I watch a lot of TV on Saturday mornings.
What Saturday mornings?
That was when Schoolhouse Rock would play in between cartoons on Saturday mornings. When
cartoons
I was a little
girl. Are on Saturday mornings?
Yes.
They used to be back in the olden days.
Ah, oh, youth.
Oh, my gosh. Hours and hours of sitting in front of mind-numbing television watching colors and shapes fly across the screens.
We have like 3 channels for that now, 4 channels for that. Just
that's the total number of channels we had growing up.
Yeah, exactly.
There was 2, 11, and 13. Well, then you did have UHF. You had 20. Well, we had 26 and 39. And then when 20 came along, that was pretty amazing.
It's a little snowy, but you could make
that. You have that round antenna that you had to move and get just right.
Oh, and the foil. That's what foil was for before we had tinfoil hats.
Yes.
Today, I just leave my TV on channel 529, which is the all-rioting channel. And it's great.
Awesome. You mean MSNBC?
They just go town to town. It's great. It's awesome. It's awesome. And you know what? That's just as good as the lighthearted Saturday morning fare I grew up with.
But is it the international rioting channel, or is it just domestic?
No, they only, every now and then, to spice it up, they throw in a soccer game. But generally, it's pretty much just here. Pretty much just here.
Oh, man. That's
and I'm going to just assume that every single one of us, when Felicia asked if it was international rioting, all of us thought soccer. How sad is that when you say international?
I thought Greece. I don't know what all you people were thinking. What is soccer? What does that mean? I don't know that.
Oh, you don't know sportsing. I don't even know sportsing, but I know that soccer people riot.
It's this game. It's this game where if you don't like the call, you get to chop off the referee's head.
No, soccer is what your kids play, you know, when they're 5 and 6 and everybody gets a trophy.
No. Outside of the United States, it's like inside the United States we have Where's Waldo, but outside of the United States it's called Where's Wally. It's like that, except outside the United States, soccer is a game where you get to literally kill people if your team loses.
Well, it's a game where people literally spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours not scoring, which is incredible. I mean, I'm not sure why, but they outlawed scoring decades ago.
Does it make people feel bad, hurt their self-esteem?
It wasn't even, and the sad thing is, in most of the socialist world, the socialist non-competitive world, it wasn't even considered really a bad ruling. So, you know,
there's that.
Soccer.
All right, let's get out of this soccer death spiral. we've spent far too much time on it. I did really want to make that point that Ted Cruz was actually in there on the Sunday shows and making that point using this cultural reference as a tool.
And we need to talk more about that.
Yeah. The problem is that not everybody's doing that. We need to be doing that. We need to be sure to use all of these tools, just like we want to use Grubering as a verb. We also want to use these weapons that we've been given just a fantastic weapon in the form of this Schoolhouse Rock thing that we need to be sharing. And I know Fishy and I on Sunday, we were just like the whole day clicking like and hitting share and retweeting people and doing all we could to make sure that video got as much exposure as possible. It's got millions of views on YouTube. We need it to get out and for more people to see it. And it's important that you do that you hit like, and that we have our politicians go out there and use it, because Ted Cruz used it, Jeff Flake didn't. And that was really annoying to me to see him go out there and not use that. Some of our other representatives that were on the Sunday shows not use that in their messaging. So
tomorrow's the day before vacation, so we can spread it out again, I think, you know, reinvigorate it.
Absolutely. I want to underline that, too, because what JD and I actually were doing is going to the different sites that had shared and written up a little blurb about the video. We were going to IJ Review. We were going to the Chicks on the Right. We were going to all these different places where they had shared it from their own original pieces, and then finding on Facebook the place where it said, you know, 700 shares, 8,000 shares, clicking on that, and it pops up a lovely little window. When you pop up that lovely little window, some of those people's permissions on their Facebook actually allows people that they're not connected to like and view their shares. And by liking those, as many as we could find, it kept it in other people's feeds. And so using that strategy, when there's something good that's come out that we can profit from, every time that you find it shared somewhere, like that, even just liking it, even on Google+, plussing it, retweeting or and things on Twitter, using that strategy just a little bit keeps that in the feeds of people who might have missed it or have been off for the week or something. That is a strategy we don't employ enough, liking, sharing, favoriting, subscribing, sharing things out, and then going back and commenting, those sorts of things. If we're going to be activists who are going to get good messaging, whether it's here that we're talking about or something Saturday Night Live did or anything that you see, if you apply that and take just 5 minutes, 10 minutes to do a little amplification, it has immeasurable benefits, and it will get it into the feeds of people that are in our lives who are not political, but then we can reach them that way. I think that can't be underlined enough as a tactic that everybody can use at any time to amplify conservative messaging.
That's a good point, and it's something that I neglect to do. I tend to not be a plus one-er because I kind of don't see the point. It's like, yeah, whatever. I'll comment on it or I'll reshare, but I don't plus one a whole lot.
I plus one the crap out of everything. And I don't know if it shows up in other people's feeds, if I have that feature turned off or not, but I definitely like people to who've shared something good to know that it's something good and that they need to do more of that. And if they get, you know, 20 pluses on something, that'll give them a message. It's a way to gauge the content that you're putting out by how much, you know, what you're receiving back in terms of feedback. So I always do it. I always do it. And it helps people gauge what is good, but it also helps them to know, you know, if they're not getting a big response or you just leave a comment, to help them know, hey, maybe that's not something that you want to share. So it goes both ways.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you said about the plus ones, it's nice. It really feels nice when you have a post out there that gets 30 pluses or a bunch of likes. It's always a good thing, and it's always a nice thing to have that. But on Facebook in particular, it does make it so that your followers get to see that you just liked something. So it's even more important to do that on Facebook. I don't know if they have that feature for sure on Google+, but for sure on Facebook, hit the like button because it makes everybody see what you're seeing. Everybody that is friends with you, they get to see that in their little stream feed thing in the upper right-hand corner, so that's important. We are at the halfway point of the show. I just want to take this time to say thanks everybody who's listening and watching. We're the Refinery. We talked about all sorts of interesting stuff in the first half. From you know the political side of things, talking about Amnesty, talking about Ferguson, talking about all that stuff. But we want to shift a little bit now into the more cultural side of things. We're into Thanksgiving week already. It doesn't really feel like that. It feels like we shouldn't be here yet, since the show is only like 6 months old. It's kind of crazy that we're here already. But we had this discussion within the group that we wanted to go and do some stuff a little bit on the lighter side, and talk about some films, talk about some movies that we enjoy that might have conservative messages in them, or stuff that we can talk about in that sort of conservative light. I know we talked about it last week that we wanted to do this. So we've all sort of pulled together, have some ideas for what we're going to do. I personally, this is a subject that I enjoy a lot. I know Andy mentioned last week how much he enjoys movies and doing reviews and things. My third ever piece on Free Radical Network, I believe it was my third ever piece, was on The Mark of Zorro. And I would love to take 5 minutes to just tell you, this is a movie that you should absolutely play during Thanksgiving. It is an excellent film, just on in terms of the action and the story and the pace, and everything is great about it. But what shocked me when I, you know, I've seen this film, I don't know, a ton of times. I'm a huge Zorro fan. I've always been. It sort of goes with Batman, all of that stuff. Zorro is just awesome. This movie this movie was made in 1940, and it stars Tyrone Power. The thing that shocked me when I watched it for the 50th time last year was how conservative, how the hero, how Zorro is basically a wealthy guy. He's like Iron Man. He comes back to his town, to his hometown. He's this aristocrat, comes to his hometown, sees a government just wrecking the place and putting taxes on just everyone, outrageous taxes. You have this government coming in, this military force coming in, cutting people's tongues out. And this is 1940. This came out, and you have an aristocrat businessman from a rich family, from a money, wealthy family, come in and be completely disgusted by what he sees. And basically, what he does is he changes he fights against the government, fights against these taxes, and gives the money back to the people. It was an outrageous message for me to see this.
So he's sort of like Robin Hood?
Sort of.
Because that's what Robin Hood did, is he didn't steal from the rich, he stole from the government.
Exactly. That's not how Robin Hood is portrayed. That's not how Robin Hood is portrayed anymore. He's portrayed as stealing from the rich. What's not talked about is how the rich was specifically the government. In this, it's more overt. It's talking about this is the governor who's doing this. This is these guys, the people who are wrecking things, the people who are being these tyrants are the government, and it is a family that runs a business basically. That's who Zorro is. He comes in and he tries to make it better for the working class. In his back in California after being in Spain, comes back to California, sees everything is messed up, and tries to clean it up. It's just a mind-blowing. It was a mind-blowing experience for me to watch this movie from a political perspective, and see just all the conservative themes and values there. I mean, it totally holds up, and it's something that everybody should watch.
Of course, I've only seen the Catherine Zeta-Jones Zorro movie, so that's a whole different deal, I think.
Why would you say that? Why would you say that? That's terrible.
Well, she was hot.
I saw that movie when I was like...
How hot was the girl in your version?
How hot is the girl in my version? Pretty hot.
Look, I'm trying to do a review here.
How's this for a review? The bad guy is Basil Rathbone. I'm pretty sure that's enough of a review right there.
When the bad guy
is Basil Rathbone, you're pretty much set.
That's pretty wicked cool, I have to admit. Okay.
Right. We'll add it to the list.
Well, good. I'm glad. I hope that we get to see the party of choice review for The Mark of Zorro a billion years after it's come out. That'll be awesome. How about you, Andy? Do you have anything?
My favorite movie ever, or?
Yeah.
Okay, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I think it's the best. It had the best pacing, the best mix of pacing. It was an incredible forerunner for the modern hero. Today's heroes, almost all of them are to one degree or another the reluctant hero. Most of them. You have the exceptions because that got played to death, but Indiana Jones was the incredibly reluctant hero who was a bit of a slob you could relate to, but incredibly gifted at the same time. Obviously, he had great performances throughout. The writing was magnificent. The acting was perfect. The character development was perfectly measured so as not to weigh down the story, but so as not to be too weak to make the story. Politically, it's fantastic because obviously it's showing at every level the evils of big government, be it America, American bureaucracy, or obviously the Third Reich, and God wins. So, you know, to me, it's the most perfect movie I've ever seen, although there have been a lot of them that, you know, I mean, if I want to see a romantic comedy, it's probably going to be Roxanne with Steve Martin, which I thought was just brilliant. So, hey, certain things make me happy, okay, JD?
I'm not going to cast aspersions over rom-coms. I'm not prepared to do that at this moment.
And a movie that let's see, that I force Corey to see. There's two movies I force Corey to see every year. And this is how we maintain the marriage. It's pretty much, you know, reliant on this. Number one is Con Air.
Really?
Yeah, it's not a good movie. I don't care. It's my kind of movie. It's a fun guy movie that is completely implausible and incredibly entertaining and has terrific everything, terrific villains. I love it. And the other
one. So you're
one,
the guy who watches that movie every year. The I, one. You're I the one.
I keep it alive. And the other one is, and we're coming into holiday season, so she knows, The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Actually, I love that movie. I love that
it
one.
It is outstanding. The Muppet Christmas Carol.
How does that work?
It's great.
It's hilarious. It's seriously hilarious. You've got to watch it.
Michael Caine is Scrooge.
Yes!
And it is. Is it funny or what?
Yes, and Gonzo plays Charles Dickens.
And you know, by today's standards, the special effects took tens of dollars to make. And it's hilarious. It's very funny. It's very, and by the way, once again, I like a movie to have a terrific pace. Another movie that has an epic pace is, and by that doesn't mean it has to be a frenetic pace, like the movie I'm going to see tomorrow, because I'm going to review it, which is The Penguins of Madagascar. Got to do that. It's a kid movie. It's the holidays. But the Princess Bride also had just about the most perfect pacing I've ever seen in a movie. To me, I love good editing. To me, when I watch a movie, I always watch it to see what potentially was left out. And I always rip a movie to see when the wrong things are left in. It's kind of like bad sculpting. If you're a bad sculptor, it's what you leave there rather than what you take away. Does that make sense?
It does. And yes, Fishy, I believe that Benedict Cumberbatch is in Penguins of Madagascar. So there's a reason for you to go and see Penguins of Madagascar if you enjoy listening to Benedict Cumberbatch.
And Penguins of Madagascar also has the same villain as Con Air.
John Malkovich.
Cage is overacting?
John Malkovich is going to be, now I'm telling you what, this is going to be his greatest dramatic performance. He's an evil squid, I believe. And I'm telling you what, this is going to stretch him.
Oh.
Okay.
Wow. Well done. Nice job.
Yeah.
I would watch John Malkovich read his grocery list. I'm enthralled. I'm enthused. I'm excited about that now.
If it weren't for Edward Norton, he might be my favorite actor. I mean, he's certainly up there. He is. Malkovich is magnificent. And
oh, that was funny. There's a bit of a reaction to Edward Norton being your favorite actor there. It was interesting. I like Edward Norton. I think he's a fine actor personally.
Oh, and I forgot one last movie. Got to mention, all of my foreign policy is based on Team America.
We can't say anything really. We can't quote Team America. We can't do anything from Team America.
Okay, I've never seen that movie, but I have linked to the YouTube of their theme song a lot because
oh my goodness.
I love it. And no, we cannot talk about it here because it's got some profanity in it, like all over it. But it's awesome.
Actually,
I can quote one moment. And then I can quote one moment. At one point, let's see, they're sending the hero in to infiltrate the terrorists. And he's made up ridiculously with a bath towel on his head and stuff like this. But they say, just so you know, if you get discovered, you may wish to take your own life. here, and you look down, they give him a hammer. Sorry, I laughed myself sick at that movie.
Well, oh my god.
I was going to say, another funny line that we can quote is at the very beginning when they're in Paris and they're going after the terrorist, and the line is, he's headed for the Louvre!
Because they've blown up everything else he's run towards, so they... And I love the beginning of the movie. I love any movie that blows up France, really. I root for the Germans in World War II movies because they mow over France.
Oh, come on.
Only during the French parts! Okay?
That's
without a heart. I'm not without a heart.
Should I mute him now?
Yeah, absolutely. Team America is an amazing movie that... if you haven't seen, you need to see. It's from the guys who created South Park. It's just there are no real words to describe it, but the fact that you have Kim Jong-il and all of the smug actors in Hollywood together in one spot and Matt Damon as a key bat. I mean, just everything about the movie is hysterical, and it's not a family film. It's not a film that you watch with your family. It's the film that you take that you get the teens to go and watch. That's what that is. It is a just absolutely hysterical though. Amazing. But on the subject of films that are family films, and stuff that I make it my business to watch every year, and generally not around this time, but The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is, again, and I don't know why I'm coming up with, like, movies that are a billion years old, but The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is about as good as it gets in terms of films, like, of all time. And it, you know, it's about self-defense, it's about the rule of law, and it has some politics involved, but you know, you've got strong immigrant characters who are making, you know, who are running businesses, and are affected by lawless outlaws who are trying to impose their will through government. I mean, it's amazing. It's really a great film, and I mean, with the actors who are in it. You know, you can't really beat John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, and just, I mean, Lee Marvin is the bad guy in that. Lee Van Cleef is one of the sort of side character bad guys. He doesn't have a line, but he's Lee Van Cleef. So, I mean, it's just, if there's a movie to see at any time, for any reason, and use Thanksgiving as an excuse, go and get The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. It's on Netflix for sure, and it's probably on YouTube because it's, you know, one of those important films that, you know, it's a part of Americana that needs to be preserved, and you need to get people to see this film. It is just so good.
Yeah, but we're not hearing the chick flicks.
All the talking.
Come on. Sabrina, the modern one with Harrison Ford. Slow moving. Look, chick flicks, and I'm going to tell you this, and I've said this before, this is coming from an ex-theater manager. I spent 7 years managing theaters. We called them cancer death movies because the big difference between men and women watching movies, and I'm not kidding now, is men want to watch a lot of bodies flying and falling very quickly. Women want to watch one person be tormented and tortured for 3 hours long. And it doesn't matter how that you kill them. They don't care who it is. They just want somebody to be, they want it to be dragged out and have them walked through horrifying circumstances for 2 to 3 hours. And it's beautiful. Go to beaches, boys on the side.
Is that a commentary on what movies you've seen? Or are you trying to tell Corey something?
I'm actually speaking as when we would book movies, we would have to plan out the concessions for them. And literally, when there was a movie that somebody was going to be tortured, tormented, and so forth for a long period of time. We literally had to stock up on chocolate. I'm not kidding. When there was a movie that was like U571, war movie, whatever, we'd have to stock up on nachos, hot dogs, that's guy food. It's just the way it is.
So the chick flick that I really like the most, I think, is probably Red Dawn.
The original, yes.
Good Lord, yes. The remake?
How is that a chick flick? And by the way, don't knock
it's
the
It's not
remake.
At all. I saw the remake as well.
It's not terrible.
Have you seen Patrick Swayze? How is that not a chick flick?
Yeah.
I'm not a chick. I don't know.
And it's people who were, it's not reluctant hero, it's all of a sudden forced by events to have to step up and be the hero, and you find out what you're made of, and you're disappointed by some people that you thought you could trust, and then you're surprised by people you can trust that you didn't think you could, so you're learning more about people than, because the circumstances are so extreme and so dire, and you're pulling together and learning what's important and what's not important, and it's family that is important, and you know, survival and defeating the Russians, because the Russians are the bad guys and they tried to take over, and you have to kick them out of your home. And what I loved the most when I saw the movie when it first came out, it was so surprising that at the end they just said the war ended as all wars do. They didn't really give you that big victorious, the war has ended and we have won. They just went with the assumption that the war ended and America survived, America won, as we always do. It was so tragic and optimistic at the same point, and it really, and you're seeing the monument to those who were lost in the war, and it connected you to all the previous wars that have been fought, but also gave you the optimism of the future that whatever comes, we can step up, because these were just high school kids who stepped up because they were asked. And if you had looked at them the day before the invasion, you would have said, no way, man, the country is toast if we're ever invaded. But then they were invaded and those kids stepped up. And it gave you that faith in the indomitable human spirit and the American experience and the fact that strangers can come together and fight for common cause. And all of that was in the 80s during the Cold War. So that was, you know, it was a time when we as people really did wonder if we were going to make it or not. And so to me, that was one of those things. And I'll watch it every now and then just as a little reminder, you know, bad stuff's going to happen, and we'll maybe look around and say, you know what, we're not up to the task. But you know what, we really are. We always have been, and we always will be.
People make fun of the movie, too, but it's not as shallow as people might remember. There's this mm-hmm. great transformation in C. Thomas Howell's character where he's completely, you know, wetting his pants, scared at the beginning, and then after they've killed his father, he becomes one of their most aggressive fighters. They never get into the details of it, but the Leah Thompson character, it's obvious that something very she'd been violated in some very personal way, and that she's still reacting and that she's angry, and that fuels some of what she does as well. And it doesn't leave these characters just, oh, here's some, let's throw them into a blender and see what happens. They actually do develop them. And the most amazing thing about the movie, I thought, was that the main heroes, the main characters, they die. They die. The people who are left
exactly
are secondary characters.
The main characters die, and we don't have the huge victorious ending. That was really quite avant-garde in filmmaking. It was quite a surprise, and they trusted the viewer. They trusted the audience, and movie makers now don't trust the audience at all. But the guys who made Red Dawn, they trusted us, and I think we stepped up to the task of handling being good viewers of that movie. At least I did. Swayze helped.
Oh yes.
What about a movie for the common guy who overcomes incredible odds and will not give up? Rudy. Who saw Rudy?
Rudy is a great sports movie.
Isn't that great? I loved it.
As an SEC fan, I can't get behind this.
Oh, God. You know, one of the things I loved the most about that movie was how it was kind of a picture of the whole American dream. He had his dream, and he was going to pursue it, and he found ways to do it because nobody got in his way. He was able to figure out a job and figure out a place to live and figure out a way to get into the college and then a way to get onto the team, and he never gave up, and eventually he got his dream.
Yeah, I mean, it was the opposite of our entire culture of excuses.
Yeah.
And everything that is in my way. He had everything in his way. He wasn't even a good athlete. Okay, and I mean, and it's a true story, which is amazing too. It all happened. So very, very incredible.
And it had awesome music. Can't get past that.
Yeah.
And see, I thought that the key thing that he had to overcome was the fact that he was being portrayed by Sean Astin.
That was up there.
Yeah. Hey now.
You're rocks. Okay. You're no.
I also like Sean Astin, so not like a Swayze like him, but I like Sean Astin. Don't go insulting Sean.
Okay.
There's a movie I want to talk about that has Sean Astin in it. It's more of a supporting role, but have you heard of Forever Strong? Have you heard of Forever Strong? It might just be a local movie out here. I'm not sure, but he's in it. It's about our local Highland High rugby team. They've won like 20 straight high school national championships or something ridiculous, and a kid comes in from Arizona, comes into like the Boys Ranch Rehab Center here, and is kind of turns his life around. The guy says he knows he's a rugby player, so he sends him to this coach, and he works out with the team and gets on the team, and his behavior gets better. And it's a cool movie because it's about a kid rehabbing and kind of living his dream, the team coming together, him realizing people really do care about him. So if you haven't seen it, it's really cool. It's on Netflix as well.
Sounds good. I thought you were going to say Lord of the Rings or something like that.
Yeah. Nope, my wife made me watch all of those once, and hopefully we are done with that now. All 8 or 9 or 10 Harry Potter movies, however many of them are those.
Well, actually, Harry Potter is another film series and book series that really portrays the damaging effects of full-out control government and large government, because as the books go on or as the movies go on, you see how this force is worming its way into every aspect of their lives. And, you know, it seems like it's this huge, just this one bad guy, but as the books and as the movies progress, you discover that, no, it's in the subtle things, too. It's infiltrating the schools. It's infiltrating the curriculum. It's infiltrating all aspects of their lives, all aspects of their home life. And that's a really good conversation starter for people if you're wanting to talk to them about government.
That's what I thought about Spaceballs.
Don't you swerve yet. I have to make this point about Harry Potter. Given how much grief people got for allowing their kids to read it back in the very beginning over the, you know, witchcraft themes or wizard themes or whatever, the fact that it's such a conservatively themed set of books and movies is incredibly good. Especially, you know, given that so many people had at the beginning such an aversion.
Well, that's part of the reason I actually read them, because I grew up in a culture, a subculture, that was like, oh, Harry Potter, if you read those, you're going to go to hell. And I was just like, come on, is it really that bad? So I watched one of the movies, and I was like, okay, well, what is this all about? And I started reading them. And we don't have time to go into it, of course, but the amount of conservative themes throughout those books is simply incredible. And the author is not a conservative person. which is also really ironic when you start looking for those themes throughout the books.
You know, there are so many movies, and this is, when we talk about politics, we talk about messaging, there are so many movies that depict big government gone awry. It's incredible. I mean, you're going to have your movie makers who want to make it, you know, a big business gone awry, you know, and this kind of stuff, but far more often it's big government gone awry. And this shows me that there are there is such a mistrust in society of the same thing we distrust.
Mm-hmm.
Connect with that, and you can connect by discussing it through movies.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's really interesting that a lot of TV shows and movies and books and really much of the culture is about conservative values, because human nature is a conservative value. And these shows succeed because they're portraying conservative values, although they're written and performed by people who are very liberal. And that kind of cognitive dissonance is really weird to me. I've never really quite figured it out, how Hollywood can be so liberal through and through, but the stories that they write and the things that they succeed at portraying are conservative values. I mean, all of the chick flicks, all of the Hallmark movie channels, I mean, sitcoms, it's families pulling together and succeeding. It's co-workers working together to achieve a common goal. It's good guys versus the bad guys, and the good guys win.
Well, yeah, that's because they know that those things sell.
Exactly.
And they want the paycheck. That's all they care about. They don't care about promoting a, you know, set of family values. Real quick, another movie, it wasn't a great movie, but it was completely opposite of what we expected it to be, and it's been a while since I've seen it, but Oblivion with Tom Cruise. It looks like it's this hyper-environmental type movie because the Earth appears to have been destroyed by mankind and all of this, but as you watch it, I don't want to give it away, as you watch it, there's a group of people that are trying to survive, and there's actually a scene with the Liberty Bell in it. You have to watch for it. It's real quick, but the speeches that they give are all about freedom and all about overcoming their oppressors. And what's really kind of funny is that the renewable energy sources that are being used on the planet are actually destroying the planet. So it's got some twists and turns that you don't expect.
I think Ryan... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's interesting. But Ryan was going to bring up a particular movie franchise.
Spectacular performance Ryan's going to bring up.
I think Andy should talk about him. He's obviously much better at talking about movies than I am. But some of my favorite movies of all time are the Dark Knight trilogy. There's so many conservative values throughout the movie. There's so many good lines in the movie. You know, one that's coming to mind right now is when Morgan Freeman is standing in front of that big machine that reads all the cell phones and triangulates and basically gives him an image of what's going on. And he just says, no man should have this kind of power. And that's what the NSA has. He's like, I will not work here if you have this. This has to be destroyed. This is not right. But throughout all three of the movies, there's so many things like that. I don't have the lines memorized. I'd have to rewatch them again. Yeah, Felicia mentioned in the chat, some men just want to watch the world burn. There's just so many good one-liners throughout all three movies on conservatism, on government, on individuality, on, you know, goodness and courage and how bad guys think. And my all-time favorite, I think, acting job or character is Heath Ledger's Joker. I think he is just so creepy and evil and mentally messed up, and he does such a good job portraying it. It's so believable to me to see this guy that just wants to watch the world burn. He just wants to have bad things happen. He doesn't really have any specific goal. He just wants to create chaos and just put people out of their element and in places they're not comfortable and see what they do and see what happens. And it just, every time I watch it, it I just think he did such a good job. It's just so creepy. So that's all I had to say about those.
Well, so often the characteristic that sets apart a great movie is the quality of the villain, not the hero. You know, I mean, anybody ever see the movie Speed with Keanu Reeves? He didn't make the movie. It was the villain who was terrific. No, I'm serious. A lot of great movies are made by the villain. Hans from Die Hard. If you think I'm talking action movies here, but
Gruber.
Hans Gruber. Yeah, but even with a lot of quiet subtle movies, Corey and I like to watch a long miniseries called what's the British one?
Pride and Prejudice.
And there are villains in that just drive the thing, you know. And Heath Ledger as the Joker, that's why I thought the second Batman movie was so much better than the other two. And the other two weren't bad movies, but, wow, that second one was unbelievable.
Absolutely. Just a final note on The Dark Knight is that one of the things that I really appreciated was the sort of test for humanity at the end and that whole process and how it was shot and just the way that everybody acted with the two ships. That scene was amazing to watch, and just the whole idea of it, the thought of not going first, not blowing up the other guy. I mean, it just everything about it was the sort of, yes, humans have this inherent, desire to not hurt each other. I think that that's a true thing, and it's maybe it's because it reflects my own personal beliefs, but to see that in a film, the way that it was presented, and with a bad guy as crazy and as nihilistic and awful as the Joker. I mean, just the way that happened, that scene was a really uplifting and great scene to me. I mean, one of my favorites of all time. Fishy.
Yeah, so this is a movie that I've loved for a long time. I don't know if anybody's even seen it. It's not one that typically shows up in favorites or people talk much about, but it's The Jack Bull. Has anybody seen that?
Nope.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, interesting. I'll put the IMDb up because it's got John Cusack in it, actually. And it's the story of this horse trader. He trades horses and he deals with them, and he's very good at it. And what happens is he runs into a conflict with the rancher that has agreed to take some horses, and he's abused them, and he's abused the caretaker he's left with him, and has decided, well, I'm not going to buy the horses because look at the condition they're in, when he actually put them in that condition. And so it's horrible to see, you know, the mistreatment here, but this is all taking place in Wyoming before it becomes a state, and so all the politics are linked up in here. Who's in with the judge, and how can they have the case thrown out so that this horse trader doesn't have any recourse, and they can just kind of good old boy their way through it? And it's the whole story of how he attempts to force this rancher to make restitution for these horses and to put them back in the condition that he gave them to him. And the story is this deep drama about the willingness that he has and the lengths to which he will go to make this guy do right. In spite of all the corruption that's around him, in spite of all the politics that's around him, he still fights on for what's right and what he's owed. And interestingly, Drake Bell of Drake and Josh, if anybody remembers that show, plays his son in it, and it was the first time I'd ever seen him. It was a really good role for him, too. But it's a great, I'm not going to tell anybody how it ends, but it's fascinating, and it's such a interesting period piece because it's set in those, you know, days before Wyoming becomes a state. It is a beautifully shot movie, but it is a stirring, gripping story, too.
That sounds a lot like Liberty Valance, just without the guns and the fighting and the, you know, Lee Marvin. It sounds very much like it, though. It very similar themes of, you know, states not yet becoming states and the way that laws worked and just the lawlessness and how things were handled and trying to get people to abide by the laws. That's a pretty big deal.
Well, especially when the entire system's corrupted around you. Another one of my favorites, Gran Torino. I adore that film. Clint Eastwood, again, you know, somebody I'd watch read his grocery list, but just an incredible performance in a well-drawn character who is so deep. And it drives home that theme about people being less threatening, I suppose, or less other when you get to know them. The persistence of getting to know someone makes relationships change so much that you know maybe you begin to see people from a whole group differently because you've had interaction with one person. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of standing up for what's right in the face of really awful bullying and horrifying things going on in these families. I love, love, love that film.
I think, you know, one of the big themes for me that I love, great movie. One of the big themes for me is the whole notion of people only valuing somebody for what they can get out of him. And because Clint's family only valued him for the desire to get his money when he died. And that showed over and over and over again. And what mattered to him with these people he met in the neighborhood, even though he didn't relate to them at all that mattered to him was that they didn't only want him around for what they could get out of him. And that was the thing that just drove through the movie for me. None of us like being loved conditionally. None of us like being only wanted for what we offer. We want to be wanted for who we are. And he was he was a mean guy, like he always plays. And yet he was wanted for who he was. And I just thought, just magnificent.
We just lost all of our Ayn Rand fans. They left. It's done. It's over.
Cool. Can we talk about them behind their back now?
I mean, we talk about them in front of their backs. So, yeah, sure. That's a movie that I haven't seen, is any of the Atlas Shrugged films. None of them.
Oh. I thought you were going to say Gran Torino, and I was going to freak out.
Oh, no. I've seen Gran Torino, and Gran Torino's excellent. It's a movie that everybody should see at least once. And as you said, Clint Eastwood is a master. He's great. The way that political correctness sort of just instantly goes away. It disappears within the context of this film. Go ahead.
No, that reminds me, just out of the blue, though, don't let me forget, when you're done, there's something I want to bring up.
A somewhat similar feeling to a movie with a great central performance and an even less sympathetic main character is As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson, who also becomes the
love
hero.
That one. So funny.
Oh, yeah. He also becomes the hero for the gay character, played by Greg Kinnear, and for the, which is ironic because he hates gay people, but he hates all people, so he's very equal opportunity. And he's just incredibly troubled and almost with Tourette's, in that he cannot stop himself from yelling terrible things. And yet he becomes a sympathetic character and even a hero to those in the movie, which I just thought was really great.
Fishy, you want to get back to that thought that you had?
You were in the middle of something.
No, I was just saying that, that political correctness in the context of the film sort of... the mutual respect between people is something that, that's very prevalent in the film, in Gran Torino. And based on that respect, that mutual respect, some awful things are said, but they're not said in a way that's meant to be hurtful a lot of the time. Sometimes they are. I mean, it depends on the character and the timing, but that kind of sort of the way that it treats people on a individual basis, I think, is a very interesting way versus categorizing them as a whole group, so as a racial group or whatever, and you know, that the way that sort of gets juxtaposed is a really interesting point of the movie, I think.
Okay, well, the thing I was going to bring up, our friend R.J. Muller, who we've seen write a bunch of things at a website called Acculturated, has done some movie reviews. Not too long ago, he reviewed The Chef, which he was making so interesting to me that I really want to see that. So the first opportunity, I'm going to get that one. I'm just throwing that out there to remind people that he has written reviews and that they can check them at Acculturated because it's a great site. But also The Birdman. He just reviewed that, and that looks like something now. When RJ writes a review, it sounds so interesting that even if it's not a subject I'm interested in, I'm interested because of the way he writes. And so those two are on my to-see list, but if anybody gets to them first, I want to hear their opinion. Not that I don't trust RJ, I do, but I'd be very interested to contrast that with his opinion.
Yeah, when I saw the Birdman sort of come up, that was I like Michael Keaton as an actor. I think he's a good actor. He was not the best Batman. He was probably the second best in terms of the movie Batman, after Christian Bale. But Johnny Dangerously and just the rest of the stuff that he's in, he's very good. I saw the trailer for Birdman, and I don't know. The way that it was presented to me, I'm not sure how I feel about it. Being a fan of the superhero genre, and how it's kind of a criticism of some of that. I don't know. I would like it's probably something that I'll catch on Netflix, not something I'm going to go see in theaters, but I'm interested.
I don't go to theaters at all, hardly anymore. The last movie I saw in a theater was when Kelly and I went to see Zombieland. And that was because it was a special near Halloween.
Excellent movie.
Love it. Love it.
By the way, for a really good, funny, recent movie, yeah, I assume everybody's already seen it, but Guardians of the Galaxy. Very funny.
Yep. Definitely good, and again, you know, all of the superhero movies pretty much have conservative values in them. So, I mean, I can't think of a single one off the top of my head that was objectionable, you know, or did, you know, did something to really offend me politically. So,
yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, which is really kind of interesting because we've been watching the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV series, which bashes conservatives constantly. So it's kind of interesting to see that flip, because you're right, those movies all have something of a conservative theme.
How weird. I watch that show and I don't see it. I don't feel bashed when I watch it.
Oh, really? Yeah, we've...
Yeah, I don't catch it.
That's where we've been like, holy crap.
Aren't you?
I smell a blog post.
It just skips right past me. I don't even... I guess it's because I love all of the Marvel movies and I watch Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. And just Marvel has those superhero movies that also sometimes have Robert Downey Jr. in them, and he's pretty cool too. So, and Robert Downey Jr. as an actor, that's a success story. I mean, the guy has overcome a really bad past, very self-destructive past, and he's become a decent contributing member of society and a funny, self-deprecating actor who does a lot of good work. I mean, that's awesome. You know, that's just an awesome, happy story, and I'm happy to see him succeed. And I like the Iron Man stories and Captain America.
Better costumes now than they did in the 70s and 80s when they were making superhero movies.
Linda Carter's Wonder Woman.
Okay, now that you cannot improve on.
That was best. That's the best, yeah. Has there been a female superhero headlining her own show or even really movie ever since? Or is Wonder Woman the last and the greatest and Linda Carter is it?
Well, I mean, there are female heroes. They're
headlining a movie?
Well, yeah, but they're more minor, you know.
Oh, well, there's been like the Laura Croft stuff.
Okay,
Laura Croft is pretty much... Sorry, go ahead.
Sexism, movie sexism, oh my God, let's do it right now.
No, seriously, that's a good point.
I would say the best female hero movies have to be the Alien series with Sigourney Weaver.
Yep.
Sure.
Ripley. I will admit that when my youngest was in utero, her name was Ripley.
There you go.
Because, yeah, she was kicking like an alien.
She was an alien.
I think that's an interesting point about the sort of lack of female superheroes in Hollywood, and the fact that this is Hollywood we're talking about, Hollywood that gets into everybody else's business and yells at us for doing so much wrong. Of course, conservatives must be sexist, conservatives,
right.
You know, whatever, all this mess, and make fun of us because of binders of women or whatever, all that stupid stuff. And they haven't been able to figure out how to, I mean... Ask Rob in the chat room how many female superheroes there are across the various comic book universes. I mean, there are so many out there that would have been excellent. The only one that I can think of, the only superhero-ish movie that I can think of that headlined with a female superhero was Catwoman with Halle Berry, and I'm pretty sure that movie doesn't actually exist.
It died. She looked good.
That brings up something else, the superhero theme movie stuff. I don't know how many of you have ever gotten into, and I'm a recent consumer of it, the What's Wrong With Whatever Movie in So Many Minutes channel on YouTube. It's Cinema Sins is the channel on YouTube, and it's hilarious. They pick apart, they nitpick. I mean, for fun and apparently profit now. Nitpick the heck out of films, and they've gone back, you know, dozens of years and then done stuff that just came out. And it's some of the most hilarious commentary to me, but I've actually caught conservative messaging in their commentary occasionally. And they are very opinionated about superhero films in general, and so they rip those to shreds when they're not up to standard, but and they even have an alternate channel for that sort of thing now. But the interesting thing, they were talking about the press conference, say, in 2012, I think, which was the big, you know, their John Cusack disaster movie and whatever. And they were talking about the press conference they were having, and they made a huge slam in the middle of it. Who's writing this press release? Is that President Obama's team? You know, just... in there.
That's
it was
awesome.
Great. It was great. And then every time in the movie that government and scientists were all working together to try to figure out what was going on and all these estimates they had about global warming were wrong and they kept being proved wrong, but this time we're right. Every time they would say that, you know, they would slam them on it. And sometimes they're just, when they pulled out something so unbelievably awful, the guys will say, oh, come on! Now the movie is just saying F you.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to check out that YouTube channel.
It's like Red Letter Media, the Plinkett reviews, except I would assume they're shorter. But YouTube is a great place for movie commentary. It's amazing. I think while we're on the topic of movies, we would be remiss if we didn't mention Econ Pop. Because of just the stuff that they do with, I mean, there's a huge diversity of movies that they've taken and used to demonstrate economic principles, and economic principles a lot of the time are conservative principles. And they've done it with movies like Ghostbusters, the Lego Movie, even just stuff that how do you get economics out of the Lego Movie? How do you do that? It's impressive. It's to say the least. But the guys over at Emergent Order have and Econ Stories just man, they do a really great job. The same guys that came up with the Hayek vs. Keynes raps and Econ Pop. It's a great 7 minutes. I've never wasted 7 minutes watching Econ Pop. I can guarantee that. Fishy, you actually have tweeted with the host over there. I know Andrew
Heaton. He knows Heaton. I'm a fangirl. That's all he knows about me, that I'm a fangirl. But every time they put out something, I tell them, you know, how much I appreciate it. And they actually made me go watch the Lego Movie, which is something. I'm the Redbox kind of gal. If it's not at Redbox, I'm really not going to watch it unless it's on Netflix or something. I just don't enjoy dollars worth when I go.
We lost you there for a second there.
No, sorry. I don't enjoy the in studio or in theater experience anymore just because it's so dang expensive. So I'm a Redbox and Netflix girl. But he actually made me watch the Lego Movie, and I was impressed with some of the stuff that was going on in there. It's really sad to find out what Batman's really like in the Lego Movie, but you know, sorry kid, but that was so awful. But at any rate, Andrew Heaton is one of the geniuses behind it as well, and he's just so freaking funny. It's adorable, and it is definitely a good place to go to learn how to take your conservative values and your conservative economic theory and look at a movie that way. It's really nice.
Absolutely. I think the first one was House of Cards a billion years ago. It was earlier this year. House of Cards was where they started, but then they moved into movies like the Dallas Buyers Club, which was an excellent, excellent video from that. I mean, I already said that all of their videos are excellent, but Dallas Buyers Club and just the economics of Elysium, that was another hysterical one. WALL-E, they did. They've gone through a lot of them. Just if you want to check out some really awesome content when it comes to economics and movies, the economics of Back to School. How do you get economics out of Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield, which is another excellent conservative movie, by the way, is Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield, which has everybody's favorite superhero in it before he was a superhero. I can't believe I just blanked on Robert Downey Jr.'s name. But everything from their catalog, I'm going to put it in the chat now. Econ Pop is excellent. And I know Ryan had a question for Andy about the Lego Movie.
No, we're going to do that another time. Andy says it'll take a while to explain, so that'll be good.
All right.
Yeah, basically, the Lego Movie, and I walked Corey through it, and you can kind of tell him what you after I walked you through it.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on it the themes at all, and then afterwards Andy explained it, and I was like, oh, okay, that ruined it for me.
Lego, yeah, maybe I don't want to be on that show when you do that.
The Lego Movie is one of the most intensely anti-God movies ever made. Ever. It is, anti-Christian God movie beyond...
This is why we can't have nice things, Andy.
Well, I don't go into a movie wanting to, find that in a movie and play it backwards and hear My Sweet Satan or whatever. When you break it down, it is unbelievable how anti-Christian it is. But there are a lot of other ones too. Pleasantville comes to mind.
Really?
Yeah, Pleasantville is very And it's also boring.
I like Pleasantville. Pleasantville is a movie that I actually I enjoy just as sort of a check on conformity and sort of the oppression of the government that they have there. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way, but and maybe that's another point to be made is that a lot of these films are subjective and there's stuff that you get out of it that clearly we're not saying that any of these films were made for conservative content. They were not made to be conservative. I'm pretty sure when John Ford was coming up with The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, it wasn't, hey, I'm going to make a really great movie for conservatives. And that's another thing that's really important is that that's not how you make good movies. You make good movies, and then they just so happen to have these things in them. So, yeah, it's just a... I don't know, I have a different view of that film. And I've read a lot of reviews from the Lego movie that might be... I haven't read anything about being anti-God or pro-God or anything, but certainly pro-capitalism is. I've read a bunch of reviews citing how pro-capitalism it is. So maybe unintentionally so. President Business, I know. President Business, but that's the thing. It's unintentionally a pro-capitalism movie, because if you think about it, the reason why the Lego movie is a thing is because it's meant to sell Legos. That's it. It's an infomercial for Legos, but I don't know.
For a better Lego movie, in my opinion, see the previous one, the Batman Justice League one. Very funny. For what it's worth.
Awesome. I didn't know that there was a previous Lego movie, so...
Pretty funny.
Very funny.
I think we're probably going to wrap it up here, but we have a whole bunch of movies to link in the chat. God, I'll be forever trying to find all the links for them for people who didn't get to find them.
Yeah, I think that the clips from this week's show are going to be pretty link heavy in the descriptions, and the message that I've gotten from all of this from the last hour is that there sure are an awful lot of entertainment choices that are not insulting to conservatives. So, you know, we hear conservatives say, oh, there's nothing good in the movie theater, there's nothing good on TV, it's all liberals. You know, it's made by liberals, but the stories support conservative values, and they're there, and we need to do a better job of talking that up. Rather than just focusing on, I like this actor, or it was great direction, talk about the good things of the movie in that it's supportive of the values of your life, not politics, but conservative values that shape and affect your life beyond politics. And we can expand our reach into the culture by doing that and by emphasizing what's already there and helping some of our compatriots recognize that it's there, and not be so negative on everything that comes out of Hollywood is crap, because you hear that a lot. And it's simply not true.
Another thing that I think that we've confirmed is that talking about movies is fun. I don't know if it's... It's something that you can do with pretty much anyone. We're coming to Thanksgiving time. There's going to be a lot of opportunity to have captive audiences. So, hey... You know, it's a good time to put on Hunger Games or put on any of the films that we talked about and talk about them with your family members.
And when you're talking about the movie, just talk about the conservative parts of it, but not be boring about it. You know.
Yeah, don't be boring about it, but talk about the movies. I mean, ask them what they think about various parts of the film. Ask them about the various themes. It's a great way to be non-threatening, not overtly political and talk about good values and good themes and good things. So,
definitely. Right, you're gonna watch the movie from a conservative standpoint, kind of trying to pull out the things that support your value system, and then you're gonna ask them and have a conversation with them in a way to shape their perspective. You don't want to you know, be a lecturer, because they're not there for a class in how to analyze a movie, but you know, you just talk about the movie, but your perspective has been changed because instead of just watching the story, you're watching the story and picking out the conservative details. And so that's what you're going to talk to them about, which is how you talk about the movie in conservative language without being boring or pedantic or whatever the words are that I'm looking for that not, and I'm not finding. So I believe that's going to wrap up another episode of The Refinery. Am I right? I'm right. So to remind everyone, you can watch us live every Tuesday night at 8:30 Central on our new website, therefinerieshow.com. And when you go to therefinerieshow.com, that landing page gives you the opportunity to watch us live, watch the most recent episode, see the YouTube playlist of all of our clips. You can follow or subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to the Party of Choices YouTube channel. You can go to where we're syndicated just in audio form on Vigilant Liberty, vigilantlibertyradio.us. But you can go to Vigilant Liberty Radio where they have our show, just the podcast audio of it, as well as a bunch of other conservative libertarian shows. And from there, you can go to Spreaker and subscribe on Spreaker, and then the podcast will show up automatically in your device. There's so many different ways to delight in our lovely voices for 2 hours once a week or more, you know? Listen a lot. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're so close to having 100 subscribers. We're like 5 away. So subscribe to our YouTube channel. Subscribe. These are the YouTube channels you're looking for. Okay, that really didn't work as far as a Star Wars kind of reference, but hey, it was movie related, so I kind of got that link, but okay, it was bad. Anyway, we will see, well, no, you'll see us next Tuesday, 8:30 Central at therefinerieshow.com. Have a great Thanksgiving, everybody, and we will see you guys all next week. Bye! Wave, everybody. Wave.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yay, everybody's waving. Bye.